Welcome. Today is the 7th of June, 2011, and there's a lot going on. There are three eclipses this month, three in 1 month. Normally, eclipses occur between four times and six times in a year. We have six this year on the books in the sky, and three are this month. We just had one on June 1st. We had a partial solar eclipse. I don't think we saw it. We weren't. It was. When was it? Yeah. Yeah, right. People west of us, in Ireland. Yeah, it started at 7:25 p.m. on June 1st. All this information is on my website under Planetary Events. And that was an eclipse of the moon, or pardon me, of the sun, solar. And in the sign of Taurus, according to the Vedic calculation, in the constellation of Rohini. That is a Vedic constellation. Okay, so the second eclipse in this month will take place on June 15th, and it will be a total lunar eclipse, and the moon will be eclipsed. The moon will be in the sign of Sagittarius and in the constellation, the Vedic constellation of Mula. And the time of greatest eclipse will be 9:12 p.m. London time. That is daylight savings time. And that will be the second of the three. You can read more detail about this on my website under Planetary Events. And the third eclipse in this month will take place on July 1st. And it'll be a partial solar eclipse, and it'll the observable part of this solar eclipse is really down in the Antarctic, so most people will not see it. But it will take place in the sign of Gemini and in the constellation, the Vedic constellation of Ardra. And the greatest eclipse time will be 9:38 a.m. London time. So it'll be in the morning, it'll be in the middle of the night, or in the very, very early morning, middle of the night in North America, for example. So that is the July 1st, and that'll be the third eclipse of the month. Eclipses are negative, generally, negative effects. So as not to bring you down, I will not read the list of negative effects. Because some people, some of my clients, when I make them aware of such things, they become very indignant. They don't like to be exposed to that. So I give you the choice of looking it up and reading it or not, as you care to. So in the middle of these two partial solar eclipses, we have a total lunar eclipse on June 15th. And so you have one July 1st, 2 weeks later, June 1st, 2 weeks later, June 15th, 2 weeks later, July 1st. And that one takes place on the full moon. The partial solar eclipses take place on the new moon. And the total lunar eclipse takes place on the full moon, and the moon will be in Sagittarius in the constellation of Mula. And you can read the effects on my website as well, if you would like to. And it gives you the timings and everything. So, what to do during an eclipse? Because they're negative energies. And why are they negative? Because the lights, the luminaries, the sun and the moon, are being eclipsed. So therefore, that's negative. And what to do during an eclipse? In Vedic times, many thousands of years ago, it was the custom to enter a river, particularly a sacred river, such as the Ganges or the ocean, or any other body of water, and chant mantras and offer prayers for purification during for the duration of the eclipse. So some of these eclipses take place for 3.5 hours, some take place for 5.5 hours. So if you don't want to do it for 3.5 hours, then do it at somewhere around the middle, at the greatest time of the eclipse. Or if you happen to be, if you're curious and you want to watch the eclipse, which is okay as long as you're not pregnant, then you can chant while you're watching. Chant prayers, chant mantras while you're looking at the eclipse if you choose to watch it. Solar and lunar eclipses are generally very inauspicious, with certain rare exceptions. I don't know of any of the exceptions. It is nonetheless an advantageous opportunity for fasting, prayer, and worshiping God. Fasting should be observed for the whole period of the eclipse in order to nullify the reactions of past negative deeds or egocentric activities. It is also recommended to give in charity to the poor or to the needy, those in need, as much as possible during the time of an eclipse. So that's another thing you can do. Or during the time of a lunar or solar eclipse. If you cannot afford to give in charity, then simply give charity within your mind. Is that just as effective? Yes. It is. And the wonderful thing about giving charity in your mind, you are not limited by your bank balance. You can give unlimitedly. So think about that now. As much as you'd like to give, and it will not set you back. Envision yourself doing it just the way you would on the physical plane. The spiritual benefit for you will be the same. Pregnant women should never look at an eclipse, since it is thought to have a potentially negative effect on the health of the fetus. So I don't know if any of you are pregnant. I'm going to assume you're not. And we don't look at the eclipsed luminary. Any questions, comments about the eclipse? I also wrote a short article on Rahu enters Scorpio, K2 enters Taurus. That too is on the website, because that is now going for the next year and a half. It too, none of this is very positive, so I'll let you read that on the website if you would like to. It's there. It's called Shifting Shadows. Rahu enters Scorpio and K2 enters Taurus. Actually, it's not bad. I mean, it tells you what the way to look at it and the way it should be looked at. Okay, now here's another article I wrote. Jupiter enters Aries. This is the only one I sent around to my mailing list, because I'm safe with this one, because it's quite positive. I won't get any hate mail in response. So, I'll read this to you, not the whole thing. the great guru and spiritual teacher of the planet Jupiter will enter the sign of Aries, the first sign of the zodiac, from May 8th, 2011, so that is a month ago, until May 17th of 2012. He will remain in Aries for just over a year. We are entering a period of creative thinking, new beginnings, spiritual initiation, rebirth, and a novel and a reconceived approach to our human challenges and problems. Aries is pure creative spirit. It is a very favorable sign for Jupiter, since it is ruled by his good friend, who? Mars. Jupiter enters Aries only once every 12 years and remains there for about a year. The pioneering, impetuous, and adventurous spirit of Mars is melded with the tempering, thoughtful, and prudent spirit of Jupiter. Positive action and auspicious accomplishment should be the result of this beneficial union. It inspires novel, original, avant-garde, imaginative, and cutting-edge thinking and solutions to social, business, and economic problems that we are now facing. So this is a great opportunity for people in power to really think outside the box and come up with some novel approaches to solve some of these problems. It absolutely is the time where that could happen. Now, whether they'll do it or not is another story, but it introduces new innovations in applied philosophy, formal education, and inspired thinking. It ushers in an advantageous time for establishing positive and purposeful means toward the improvement of social, educational, financial, and spiritual conditions in our world. We still are in a situation, we meaning many, many countries in the world, many people, where we are yet behind the eight ball when it comes to finances, the economy, jobs, social welfare, the banking system. I went into the bank the other day and I deposited two checks I got from America. And she stamped the back of it and said, "Sign this." I said, "What's this for?" "This is to say that this check may not clear for another 4 weeks." I said, "Why? You're planning on going out of business?" He says, "You're acting in fear. What's with all the fear? You normally don't do that. What are you afraid of?" The girl, this poor girl, was looking at me. I couldn't resist. Sorry. I'm like that sometimes. And when I'm like that, that's when my wife silently leaves the bank. She disappears. He's acting American again. Okay. Jupiter in the sign of Aries is not passive or reflective, but dynamic, action-oriented, and highly motivated. Many people will gravitate toward renewed religious and spiritual practices in order to reinvigorate and reinvent their lives in terms of higher purpose and meaning, rather than rampant materialism and sensory dissipation. If you want to take a position of leadership in your own life or in the lives of others, then there is no better time to step up and be counted. Daring, courage, and bold action will be rewarded in the coming year. Bold action. This is a favorite term here in Ireland. The people who are listening to this on the podcast in America aren't familiar with this term, being bold. This is very common here. So bold action. It is a time for enthusiasm, self-confidence, and motivating others to act. Time spent shrinking from duty, feeling sorry for yourself, or whimpering about injustice is over. The bell has rung and the horses are now out of the starting gate. But remember, we must be guided by the self and not the ego. If we are propelled by the paltry and self-serving ego, then the recent economic meltdown and its concurrent problems will occur again before long. But if we are motivated by the higher self, then we will inevitably step into the winner's circle with shouts of victory all around. There are only three roles one can play in life. What are they? Victim, victimizer, and victor. 90% or more of the world's population is plagued by the mutual codependency of the victim-victimizer dynamic. In order to step into the winner's circle as the victor, we must victimize no one, nor be victimized by anyone. We set this challenge before you now, under this most propitious influence of Jupiter in Aries. Become the victor. This is a time for a regeneration and rebirth to a new way of life. If you are the man or woman with the mission, your day has dawned. It is time to establish your ideals and higher standards and gather the rest of us upon the wave of your dedication and zeal. And there you have it. And then the rest of it is what Jupiter in Aries means for you, depending where you, if you have any planets in Aries in your Vedic chart. So that you can, again, it's under planetary events on the website. Hey, Antonio, where are we going to put you, buddy? You sure? Good to see you. Okay. I want to share this with you. Somebody sent it to me. We've talked many times about the different yugas or ages or eras or epochs that the universe goes through, like the seasons. And this, of course, is widely available or described in the Vedas. So in Satya Yuga, the golden age, people live for how long? Do you remember? Let's do it the other way around. In Kali Yuga, the iron age, the age of darkness, quarrel, and hypocrisy, the current age, people live for how long, generally? 100 years. 100 years. So this is like the winter of our discontent. Then, the next age after this would be the golden age. Satya Yuga. Satya means? Truth. In the golden age, if you want the length of the ages, the Kali Yuga lasts for 432,000 years. Iron age. The golden age lasts for how long? 1,728,000 years. And what is the lifespan of a human being in the golden age? 100,000 years of age. On Earth. On Earth.
In one body.
In one body. Now, the people there are much, what? Taller. Taller. And when you read about the people who are living in the golden age, because everybody is God conscious, I mean, everybody. They automatically spend generally one-tenth of their life in spiritual practice. in some kind of austerity, penance, vow, you know, something like that. That's common. You know, whether you meditate or do yoga or stand on your one foot with both arms in the air, they do that. And just stand there and don't move. Even today in India, some people do that. But the people are much larger. And as you go through the ages, the people become shorter. And we're seeing that now. And by the time the Iron Age is over, people become very small. So, try not to take another birth in this age. So, the last age was the Dwapara Yuga. So, silver after gold, Satya Yuga. Silver, the Treta Yuga. The lifespan there, the length of the age is 1,296,000 years. People live for a lifespan of 10,000 years. And then the next age, the Bronze Age, Dwapara Yuga, is 864,000 years in duration, and the people live for 1,000 years. Okay? They are a little shorter. Now, when Krishna was on the planet, that's Krishna there in the middle, being offered a flower by his beloved Radha. And when Krishna was here, which is 5,000 years ago, and there is proof of this, archaeological proof, he spoke the Bhagavad Gita, the science of yoga. And he was trying to intervene so a war would not take place between the Kauravas and the Pandavas, who were related family, cousins. And he was trying to diplomatically stop this war from happening. But the war was kind of inevitable because it was meant to reduce the burden of warriors upon the earth. There were too many of them. During that time, one of the Pandavas met a very powerful ogress. They call her an ogress, a demoness who had some supernatural powers. And she was very big. Now, this guy, Bhima, was a big, strong guy. He was a prince. But this ogress was even bigger. And she fancied him. Although her brother wanted to kill him and eat him. He wanted to eat Bhima because he was... If somebody eats people, then generally he's considered not, you know, an ogre. So she didn't want her brother to eat him because she was sweet on him. So they pooled their resources and they killed this big demon. Hidimba was her name, was his name, and her name was Hidimbi, the sister. And Bhima and Hidimbi married. He didn't stay with her. He married her, and she was then with child. And she gave birth to a huge giant of a man called Ghatotkacha. And you can read all about this if you like. I've read about it a few times. And this guy was a real powerful guy. And then when this war inevitably took place, he was a great hero in this war, and he, you know, knocked off a lot of the enemies, and etc. So this is what was discovered in India. That is a grave. That is a man, a modern man bending down right there. This is a man here, a normal man.
Oh.
Hi, Eilish. And this is a man here, and another man, and that's the head, that's the torso, those are the legs. I'll pass it around. I'm not sure when it was found, you know. Maybe in the last few, I don't know, a few years. There is a JCB, a big tractor, up top there. That's good toe touch, I'm telling you. That's the guy I'm telling you about. Now, don't forget, this was the Bronze Age before this age.
But why weren't there more found?
More people.
How many do you need? She wants to collect a few, I guess.
No, I do believe.
I'll leave the trolley.
And then at the bottom is, I think that's yet another different one. India. I don't remember. Yeah, well, I'm trying to show you that people were different sizes in different ages. Well, but this guy was like a giant. He wasn't like regular. So. Yeah. Gulliver and the... The gods too. For the first three yugas or epochs in universal time, the Golden Age, Satya Yuga, the Silver Age, Treta Yuga, Bronze Age, Dwapara Yuga, the gods would come and go all the time. The celestials, demigods, angels, if you like to call them that. They didn't necessarily have... Well, some of them had wings, yeah. They weren't just strictly according to the Christian conception of... Even though their Gandharvas are said to have wings. Gandharvas are the musicians, singers. Which I guess, choir of angels. You know, makes sense. Okay, now what was my point? So... They would come and go. They would be here all the time. But from the advent of the Iron Age, finished, they don't come anymore. Because, we'd arrest them and take them to a lab and do stuff to them, as you know. So, here, pass that around, please. So I thought you might enjoy that. Okay. Has anybody got any stories they want to share of their wonderful transcendental experiences in life? Coincidental, serendipitous.
I was just thinking about what you said with the toilets. That my son lives in LA and he's having his tonsil out. He's 26, but he had a lot of trouble with his throat. And I was in India. So I couldn't be with them during the operation, so I said I'd light a candle and I'd sit and meditate while he was having the operation.
Perfect.
So I sat outside. I told you that was him. I sat outside. I was in Goa and I sat outside and there's a candle and I just connected him very close to the sun and I connected in with him and I saw him lying on the plinth or whatever, and I saw four figures, really tall figures, standing either side of him and head and toe of him. And I thought, what are you doing there? You know, I'm meditating and looking after my son. Who the hell are you? What are you all doing there already? And I was really taken aback by that he already had protection, but I really didn't need to do anything. I did sit there for the hour, and then I spoke to him the next day, and I said, how did it go? And he said, it went fine. And I said, I had this vision. And he said, I saw them as well.
Wow.
And I was really completely, he said, I saw them. And I was just completely bowled over. But they were really, really tall. Matt, he's very tall. He's 6'3". But these are really tall. suppose, is very taken by them when you were just talking about the tallness.
Mm-hmm. They're very tall. If they appear to you now, or like you have described, celestial beings are taller. If you want to test this out, because a lot of people will tell you they are avatars, if you want to test it out, they will cast no shadow. Their feet will not touch the ground when they walk. Generally, you will oftentimes, depending on how high a being they are, you will smell very wonderful fragrance, like rose or different things. When these beings appear, sometimes you can smell fragrances. Just, you know, wow, what's that? You know, what is that beautiful smell? That's one of them. But you can't see them. Well, you could, if you could. So, I mean, that's there. These are some of the ways of knowing. They don't blink. They never blink. There's no need to blink. We blink. But if you blink, you miss something. So there's another symptom of celestial beings. No blinking. Okay. Today, I want to tell you about Radha and Krishna. Most people, when we think about God, we think about God in terms of His power and His might and His splendor and His awesomeness. And His majesty. And that is a legitimate way to think about God. But it's the bottom level. And Vishnu, who is God, He is on the right with His consort, Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, or Shri, she's also called. He typically appears in a four-armed form. That's one of the things about the gods. They can have more than two arms. You can get a lot more done that way. And Vishnu typically appears in a four-armed form. But Vishnu is very formal. And you'd be on your best behavior. There'd be protocol. Just like the Queen was here recently. And there's protocol when you meet the Queen, or supposed to be. So Vishnu is very much like that. I mean, if God appeared in front of you right now, you'd probably hit the deck. Or you'd be stunned, or you wouldn't be able to speak, or you'd cry, or you'd hide. I don't know. It would be overwhelming. It would be awesome. And that's usually what we think about when we think about God. But the closer you get to God, the more the formality slips away. So, according to a Vedic understanding, there are five primary rasas or relationships. And they are Shanta, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya. Shanta means neutral. Neutral means on reverence, where you have on reverence for God. As I said, that's your first stage. In Islam, their favorite expression is Allahu Akbar, which means God is great. Is God great? Absolutely. The next level is dasya. Dasya means serving, servitorship, servitude, where you are so overwhelmed with God being great that you want to serve. I can't, it's not enough for me to realize that God is great and to worship God. I really have to engage myself in serving God, directly, indirectly. And that's usually where you find people in the clergy, temple, for people who become priests, nuns, or, you know, dedicate their lives to God because they want to work directly. Then these two levels are fine, but they're the low levels. Then you go to the next level, which is sakya, which is friendship. And now you're actually approaching God on an equal level. So we go beyond servitorship and we go to, and beyond formality, we go to familiarity, which is what friends are. What can you say to your friend? What can't you say to your friend? Can you shove him, push him, and joke around? Yeah, you can. With some of them. You can sit down together on the edge of the bed and talk. You know, you can do anything. Go for a swim. Go to the movies. Go play tennis. It's friendship. Confide. This too you can do with God. God will make himself available for that. So the wonderful incarnation of Krishna is the incarnation of God wherein all of these different rasas. Rasa means mellow, taste, or relationship. All of these rasas become embodied in this particular incarnation of God, who was on the planet 5,000 years ago. Souls who meditated on God in these different rasas to be with God in a more intimate way, and then became liberated souls, whereby they purified themselves of all their negative karma and all of their material contamination. Material contamination means when a soul comes down into the material realm and becomes and touches the material realm, associates or lives and acts within the material realm, he becomes contaminated. He becomes, darkened, if you will, by a lower energy. And then acting in different incarnations, taking different bodies as we do, then we become imprinted with all of these material thoughts, desires, conditioning. All of this is a certain kind of contamination affiliated with the body, which covers the soul. So the only way you can get to God is by removing this outer contamination, because underneath it all is the soul, and the soul is always pure, divine, pure, complete, can't be touched by any of the elements. So it's not like you have to become a spiritual person. You already are a spiritual person. And by removing the contamination, the imprinting, the negative conditioning, one then arrives at one's pure spiritual self. And what are the three symptoms of the pure spiritual self, pure soul? What are they? There's three symptoms. We have them. God has it as well. Sat, Chit, Ananda. What's it mean? Sat. It's truth or eternity. We're eternal. And it also means pure, uncontaminated. No darkness. None of the material shadow attached to you. None of the ego imprint. Sat. Chit means consciousness, but it also means understanding, revelation, realization, knowledge. When you become God conscious, you know everything. Does that mean you have a PhD in astrophysics? Not exactly. It means you understand astrophysics and where it fits in to the scheme of things. And it fits over here in this little corner. It's this big. There's astrophysics. You know, you probably could enter into it, but it's okay, that's that. You know. So you understand how it's all connected, how it all works. Chit. So it's full consciousness, full realization, full revelation. There's nothing you don't understand. One of the most difficult things about being a human being is we get confused. We get bewildered. And we don't know the answers to things. We've all been there. It's very difficult sometimes. But when you are chit, fully realized, there's no confusion. There's no bewilderment. All questions are answered. When? Instantly. Sat, chit, ananda. What is ananda? Bliss. So, happy because we're going to Disneyland? No. Happy because we got a new car? No. Happy because we just had a really nice meal? No.
We are Disneyland.
We are Disneyland. You are it. So happy for no reason in particular, just because. For the pure joy of it all. Unadulterated bliss. Because you are completely in touch with your spiritual nature. And whatever's going on out here, positive, negative, in between, doesn't matter. Because actually, it doesn't matter. Only we think it matters. So that's the third symptom. Sat, Chit, Ananda. We have these. This is the natural condition of the soul. You have all this. You don't have to go get it. You don't have to come to my house to get it. You don't have to go to your house to get it. You don't have to go anywhere. You already have it. It's just covered over. It's like if you go up into the attic and you look for something that you know is up there, but you're not sure where it is, you start moving stuff around, uncovering things, taking things out of boxes. Same idea. Until you find it. Same thing. And when you find it, you go, ah, here it is. Right? So it's like that, but only more. A little bigger. Okay, so Sat Chit Ananda. So Krishna's incarnation, the purpose of that was to express love. On what level? Every single level. So those who saw God as a very powerful being, in awe and reverence, in the Shanta Rasa, the neutral exchange, saw him as a powerful being and were dazzled by him. And he did many, many unbelievable things. Krishna didn't do miracles like nowadays we say, well, can he do a miracle? What he did was so far beyond miracles that, you know. One time they didn't do a proper sacrifice for Indra, the god of rain. Each thing that takes place in the universe is controlled by a celestial being, a demigod, a higher being that's in charge of that thing, like rain, like wind, like fire, different things. So Indra expected a sacrifice done on his behalf because he brings rain. And so Krishna convinced his family. It was actually his foster family who were cowherds, cow protectors, essentially. Nowadays you call them dairy farmers. Well, they wouldn't call them dairy farmers back then. He convinced them, never mind this, you don't have to do the sacrifice for this god. Just do a sacrifice and let's give thanks for what we have. Govardhan Hill is where all the cows are and that's where they eat. And it provides us with, the rivers come flow down this great huge hill and we get water. And there's various kinds of minerals and gems and jewels and that the hill produces. So we'll worship the hill. So they did. So Indra became very upset and very angry because he didn't get his due. So he brought the rains and the storms of devastation down upon Vrindavan, which is the village where they lived. I mean, it was horrendous how much rain was coming, pounding down in wind. And so Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill with the little finger of his left hand and held it up like this. This is a depiction of that, but here they've got him with his whole left hand, but it's actually the little finger, the left hand. That's a batik. And the hill became an umbrella for all the townspeople, and it protected them from the vicious storm. And he held it there for 7 days. And everything underneath the hill was nice and calm, and everybody went on with their life, and everything was fine. So after 7 days, Indra began to realize, who is this guy? Who's holding up the hill? He didn't know. And so that is an example of the awesome power of Krishna. So in terms of God doing things that are beyond the pale of human endeavor. So there are certain souls, liberated souls, who meditated on God to have different relationships with him, intimate relationships. Some of them meditated on becoming his friends. Some of them meditated on becoming his servants, which he had. There's one of the peacocks walking by there. He'll be coming down here in a moment. There he is. And some of them meditated on being his friends, and some of them meditated on being his parents and older people, you know, adult type of caretakers. Just like when Jesus came, he had Mary and Joseph. So they had a parental relationship. So Krishna had Yashoda, his mother, strictly speaking, his foster mother, and Nanda, his foster father. And then the older, or their contemporaries, you know, the older men and women, the adult men and women in the village, who are like his, you know, uncles, aunts, people like that. And then the highest relationship with God is an intimate relationship. And God also takes wives. And he took, actually in that incarnation, he took many wives for different reasons. Sometimes just out of the need to rescue women who had been kept in captivity when he freed them. But the crown jewel of the Madhurya Rasa, or sweet loving exchange, intimate pastimes, was the relationship between Krishna and Radha. And when you read about these pastimes, you begin to realize that it's a love that goes beyond everything. If you can try to imagine, when you can love unconditionally, and many of you probably have experienced some degree of unconditional love, especially it may be with your spouse or your partner, it's possible. Some people have experienced that, not a lot. It may be with your children. You can experience unconditional love for your children, generally when they're quite young, and then they develop egos. And once they develop egos, that unconditional love wanes a little bit. I don't know if you noticed that or not. Still, you do what you have to do for them. But it gets a little harder when the egos begin to appear. I think you'll agree. I know this from direct experience. So it's about developing that degree of unconditional love and a depth of loving, and what it's like to love God on that level. So what we're all looking for in the material world is the peak experience, the highest highs. And what are three or four of the peak experiences? I can think of four in the material world. One of them is sexual nature, and that's orgasm, because orgasm is supposed to be a heavenly type of pleasure. Any experience where you lose yourself and can no longer control yourself and your behavior, when you are swept up in that experience, is a peak experience where you cannot define the parameters and conduct yourself accordingly or in a normal fashion, is a peak experience. So orgasm is one.
Giving birth to another?
I don't know about that, but I mean, it's a point, you're right. But you... It could be. What?
When you first meet them.
Oh, yeah, that's all right.
When you first hold your baby, yeah, that might be, yeah, why not? It could be a peak experience.
Drugs?
Hmm?
Drugs
could definitely be a peak experience.
Marriage?
Marriage could be a peak experience, yeah.
Falling in love.
Falling in love. Love. Love is a peak experience. And that's, what's the thing that everybody yearns for? What's that?
Union?
Yeah, union, but love. Love that takes you out of yourself. And if you listen to the love songs, then when you're being silly and you're floating off the ground and all this poetry that they Is that not a peak experience?
Definitely.
You know, my world has been turned upside down by you. Now, why would you want that? I love it. That's love. Birth is a peak experience. Death is a peak experience. But the peak experience is love. So there are different kinds of love, but there's also that intimate. You can actually have an intimate relationship with God. You can become the wife, become the lover. It's possible. It depends what your meditation is. And you can meditate like that. It's acceptable. So Krishna was extremely, extremely attractive. The most beautiful person anyone ever saw. And it was completely distracting and off-putting. And nobody could behave properly when they saw him. They couldn't control their vital symptoms. They couldn't control their horripilation, the hair standing on end, or perspiration, or their words, or their heart rate. Couldn't control any of it. He was so, so attractive. Krishna means attractive. The verb is krish. It means to draw, to pull, to attract. So Krishna means the most attractive person. And anybody who was around him could not bear, having been around him, to no longer be around him. So in the morning, he would go off with his cowherd boy friends, and he'd go to the forest to herd the cows. Did he have to go to herd the cows? He was placed in the home of Nanda Maharaj, King Nanda, who was the king of all the cowherds in Vrindavan. Extremely wealthy. And it said that he owned 900,000 cows. All white. Cows were all white. And if you read the descriptions of the place, the home palace in which they lived, I mean, everything is studded with precious gems. There are columns of lapis lazuli and malachite and red coral, and the floors were crystal, and on it goes. I mean, unbelievable, fabulous wealth, because it's God. That's how God lives. And he didn't have to go and herd the cows, but that was part of his rasa, his mellow, and his leela. Leela means play. Divine pastime. Divine play. So he could play with his coward boyfriends by looking after the cows, the calves, the cows. And then at night, he would sneak out of the house in the dark. And he'd go to the forest and play with whom? Not the boys. With Radha and the other gopis, the coward girls. And that's what he would do at night. All each of these souls' desire was to have a certain kind of relationship with God. And because these souls had meditated on this relationship, had freed themselves from the cycle of repeated birth and death, and were able to achieve the vision or direct darshan, vision of God directly, they were given the opportunity to enter into these various relationships with God directly. So who is this possible for? Anybody. You. Me. it's way, way more exciting than thinking of God only as this powerful being. It's far more intimate. It's more informal. It's fun. It's beautiful. There's music. There's dance. In the spiritual world, all speech is song, and all movement is dance. So this is the spiritual world come down to earth. And this pastime of Krishna and Radha and the gopis, etc., and the cows and all this is an eternal pastime. These four yugas, Satya Yuga, Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age, equal, added, taken together, are 4,320,000 years. Times 100 of those is one day of Brahma. 4,320,000,000 years. Day of Brahma. Brahma is the creator. Creates all the diversity within the universe. Krishna appears once in a day of Brahma. 4,320,000,000 years. He appears once. Solar years, human years. He appears once. Right in the middle of that day, midday, which was 5,000 years ago. He was just here. And then this eternal Leela goes on eternally, like the sun. He is, has been here all day, and now you see, he'll disappear, and he'll appear somewhere else. So this Leela occurs in the same fashion. Now it'll appear in the next universe. That's the idea. When people meditate on this intimate relationship to God in any one of these, different kinds of rasas or mellows, then if you get off the wheel of samsara, repeated birth and death, you become liberated at the end of this life, then your soul would go first to be with Krishna in this leela that takes place down here in the material world. It's spiritual, but it's manifested here. And then in the spiritual world, it goes on as well. But you wouldn't get there. You'd get there afterward. Yeah, so you'd have to get trained up a little bit. Learn the ropes. So, let's read a couple things. I was going to read this to you. So Krishna played the flute. When Krishna played the flute, everything would stop. It was the most beautiful sound anyone ever heard. He was an expert flute player. Not just his expertise in playing, but the sound that he would make. And it would have an effect on everything. People and animals and plants would become stunned when they'd hear it. And all these different effects. Krishna's face looked very attractive, brightened by his beautiful white teeth, shining with his fresh leaf-like lips. Receiving a kiss from Krishna's dazzling, smiling face, the flute enjoyed the same fortune as his charming lovers. So the flute got kissed. Indeed, the murali, or flute, is devoid of defects, even though it's full of holes. It is astonishing that this hard flute softens the hearts of heartless people. It would melt everyone's heart. And it would silence the deer, the birds, and other forest animals. It'd be a state of suspended animation. There he is. Where is he? He's coming. Let's go. Let's go find him. Though derived from bamboo, which is vonksh, it infects all chaste women with intense attachment to Krishna, Madhupati. Madhupati is a name for Krishna, means the Lord of honey or sweetness, Lord of sweetness. The concept here is that when you're in love with God, you'll sacrifice anything and everything to be with Him. That's the price of admission. To be with God is to be willing to sacrifice everything, because the love is so deep. Just like in the material world, sometimes a person is married, but maybe not so happy in the marriage, like a woman. And then she meets somebody, a man, and he becomes her lover. And this brings great excitement into her life, even though she's misbehaving, yet she can't help herself because she's too caught up in the moment and the loving relationship and sexual relationship. So when she's at home, she does her work and her duties as a wife even more attentively while she thinks of her lover, because she doesn't want to be found out, so that she can run off and be with her lover when the opportunity arises. So that is a perverted reflection, or a shadow reflection of what it's like to love God. Whatever else you might do, it's secondary, or it doesn't come close. So it is that level of loving commitment and loving desire that one must achieve in order to get to that level of relationship to God. It doesn't have to be a lover relationship. It can be a friend relationship. You can be the parent, whatever it might be. But this expands one's options in how one can relate to God and what's actually available. So, any questions or comments about that? By nature, Krishna's flute is simple and sweet, but according to the mood of the listener, it manifests as nectar to some and poison to others. It's poison to others because some people didn't like Krishna, and there were people trying to kill him off from the time he was born, because he was here to, among other things, he had an uncle that had usurped the kingdom, and the uncle was told that there would be somebody that would be taking birth, and he would kill off the uncle and put an end to his stealing the kingdom. So, and that was his uncle Kamsa. So for him, the flute was poison. The flute causes river water to freeze solid and hard mountains to melt into rivers of ecstasy. Dead trees spring to life with fresh green leaves. Sages fixed in spiritual meditation become restless and agitated. Among relishable objects, the best thing is the sound of Krishna's flute, which completely maddens one in bliss. It removes the anxieties of all people and stops the movements of birds and animals. Thus, the sound of Krishna's flute is a treasure house of wonders. All glories to the super excellent vibration of Krishna's flute. Although there were unlimited groups of gorgeous gopis, all of these gopi girls or coward girls, Radha being the chief among them, were absolutely stunningly beautiful. They all had the great fortune of achieving the highest stage of love for Krishna. The gopis had peaceful natures and the same object of meditation. Well, what is our object of meditation? But the object of meditation is God. So whatever you conceive God to be, that is your object of meditation. But ultimately, even if our object of meditation is different, it's still the same. Because ultimately, our object of meditation is God. You might have a different conception of God. That's fine. But it's like, you know, the six blind men standing around the elephant. Describe the elephant, please. And each of the blind men will tell you what the elephant looks like by touching the elephant, a certain part of the elephant. But it's all the elephant. Same. So, we're meditating ultimately on the same thing. The gopis had peaceful natures and the same object of meditation, namely the desire to attain Krishna. These splendid beauties of Vrindavan prayed only for Krishna's supreme friendship. With great yearning, they looked in the direction of the flute and embraced each other due to the sudden derangement of their minds. So this is the effect that the flute had. Overwhelmed with ecstasy, they uttered some sweet words to describe the transcendental qualities of Krishna. In this way, the gopis passed the day glorifying their beloved with poetic compositions. When the cows heard Krishna's flute, they would cock their ears in rapt attention and close their eyes in bliss. The sound of Krishna's flute enters their ears like a constant flow of nectar. In such a state, the cows appear like statues painted on a canvas. As the cows become inert from the captivating sound, their teeth look very beautiful with the half-chewed sprouts of grass hanging out of their mouths. While holding their mother's udders, the calves neither suck milk nor let go, or swallow the milk already in their mouths. The pleasing sound of Krishna's flute steals the minds of the cows and fills them with satisfaction. At that time, Mother Earth happily drinks the milk automatically streaming from the cow's udders. Hey friend, abandoning their usual flighty nature, the birds of Vrindavan listen attentively to the sweet sound of Krishna's flute while relishing the beauty of his transcendental form. Did you ever see a woman walk into a room or a man walk into a room and you went like that. Maybe you didn't do that like the face I'm making, but you did that inside. Right? So that's what, when Krishna walks in, everybody does it. Everybody. Male, female, everybody does it. It's the most beautiful person you've ever seen anywhere. Like that. With their eyes closed in meditation on the music, they look just like sages steeped in bliss. O friend, they have stopped flying, singing, and eating. These are the birds, right? Becoming fully absorbed and tasting the pleasant sound of Krishna's flute. They tasted the sound. Why? What happens in the spiritual realm? The senses are interchangeable. You can see with your tongue. You can taste with your eyes. You can hear with your skin. Every sense does what the other sense does. Now go home and meditate on that for a while. No. In the spiritual world, you don't get fat. You can eat as much, well, you can get fat if you want to get fat. You can eat as much as you want, you don't get fat. Even in the heavenly planets, it's the same. You don't get fat, you don't get sick. Here, it's a bit different. The birds have stopped flying, singing, eating, becoming fully absorbed in tasting the pleasant sound of Krishna's flute. The birds have fluffed out their feathers due to ecstatic feelings of devotion. Even the animals felt devotion to God. Listening to the sweet sound of the murali, the flute, the Yamuna River and other rivers are intensely agitated and start to spin in whirlpools. It seems they have been struck by Cupid's arrows and affected by a type of epilepsy. Cupid in Sanskrit is called Madana. Madana. And Madana means, in that one of the meanings for Madana is madness. Because when Cupid strikes, people go, they go mad. Correct? It's a form of madness. And Krishna is called Madana Mohan. He who bewilders Cupid himself. Cupid becomes bewildered by Krishna. He is the ultimate Cupid. So, and a lot of the prayers are actually some of the same prayers that would be said for Cupid. Those who worship Cupid, well, we don't, you know, in Vedic we call him Madana or Kamadev, the Lord of Desire. Now, we have a beautiful carving of Cupid's wife, Rati. Rati means loving, taste, intimacy. And you see her bow. She has a bow like Cupid. And Cupid's animal totem is the parrot. There's a parrot there. And what does she shoot with her bow? What kind of arrow? That same arrow as Cupid shoots. What is it? Pushpa. Flowers. Shoot flowers. You get hit by the flower, you're finished. You go into a state of bliss, madness,
Been there.
Exactly. So the guy who bewilders even Cupid himself. Right? There's another name for Cupid, and it is Ananga. So Anga means body. Body. Ananga means nobody. Bodiless. Right? So one time the gods had been overpowered by the demons. And the demons were controlling the universe. So the gods wanted to approach Shiva. You know who Shiva is? Shiva is a very, very powerful being who is, you know, he's in charge of different things, but everybody knows him for being the guy who's in charge of destruction or annihilation of the worlds when the time comes. And it wasn't May 15th or May 21st, by the way. That wasn't the day. Even though many thought it wasn't. And there won't be no annihilation or even minor annihilation of any kind for another 427,000 years. So you can take a breath. So Shiva is always in meditation on Vishnu. And Shiva doesn't really care much about formality. And, you know, he's a real hardcore yogi. And he lives in the Himalayas on Mount Kailas. And the god said, okay, well, we need Shiva to mate with his wife, Parvati, because we want them to produce a super being, child, boy, who will be able to overpower the demons and defeat them so we can get control of the universe back. So this was their concocted plan. So they said, well, who is going to volunteer to disturb Shiva in the depths of his meditation? Shiva, who can glance at you and reduce you to sticks, ashes. And, of course, nobody wanted to go and do that. So they pushed your friend, your man forward, Mr. Cupid, Madana. You go do it. I don't want to go, he said. No, you have to go because you need it. Hit him with one of your flower arrows so he'll look over and see his wife and go, whoa, it's time to mate. So, did it go according to plan? No, it didn't. So, Cupid went to incite Shiva to lusty behavior. Shiva opened his eyes, saw Cupid there, and fire shot out from his eyes, and Cupid was immediately torched to ashes. So he is called Ananga, the bodiless one, because he got torched. We were reading the other day about in the material world, you have the choice of the following bodies: one-legged, two-legged, three-legged, four-legged, multi-legged, many-legged, and legless. Which I know in Ireland means you're drunk, but this is a different kind of legless. So, what are they? Obviously, you are in a two-legged form. We are. And the gods are also two-legged. So, one-legged is ghosts. No, these are not fixed forms. These are movable forms. One-legged is ghosts. Two-legged is humans, gods. Three-legged is old man with a cane. Well, it was in there. Old man with a cane. Four-legged, obviously, animals. Multi-legged is? Many-legged? Insects? And legless? Serpents. Serpents, legless.
Two legs and Irish.
Mm-hmm. Two legs what?
Two legs and they're Irish.
Okay. Hey, friend. The rivers shivered in ecstasy from hearing Krishna's flute. Are holding lotus flowers in the hands of their waves to offer him pushpanjali. So when you offer the flower like this, it's pushpanjali. This in Sanskrit means anjali. When you go like this with your hands to make an offering, it's anjali. And if you go in the river, you go into water and you offer like this, the water. But you put the flowers in and pushpa. Now it's pushpanjali. You offer like this, and then in the mood of his lovers, the rivers respectfully offer cool water to happily bathe Krishna's feet and remove the heat of walking on the burning earth of summer. The clouds, acting like friendly sakhis, sakhi means close friend, cool down the hot air by pouring tiny droplets of water upon his head. Observing that every living entity was nicely serving Krishna, except herself, one sad gopi, cowherd girl, said, "Even the cloud, which is an unconscious entity, can show his affection by moving here and there to act as an umbrella, shielding Krishna from the scorching rays of the sun. When Krishna plays his flute, the clouds remove the fatigue of cow herding by pouring tiny streams of water from all directions, which seem like a shower of camphor dust." Overwhelmed in love for Krishna, they embraced each other and spoke as follows, "O friend, the sound of Krishna's flute is a powerful yogi, transforming the nature of reality with his mantra. It makes the conscious become unconscious and gives life to the lifeless. O friend, look, all the aquatics, birds, and deer remain stunned like statues. The trees, earth, and mountains melt into liquid, and the hairs on their bodies stand erect. Seeing the flute's ability to drastically alter the state of other moving and non-moving entities, the gopis worried about upholding their marital vows. The gopi said, "Can any young woman possibly stop the low sound of that resonating flute which Krishna started playing upon attaining youth? It is so terrible that it brings about a state of death like that induced by drinking poison. Rather than stopping it, we simply become playthings in the hands of that flute. That flute sound is a blemish on our family. But if we cannot hear it, then we die in the pain of separation." So, those are some of the effects that Krishna has on the locals. So it is a state of, a very, very high state of bliss and joy, rapture. So, questions, comments? Where Shiva meditates? Kailash? K-A-I-L-A-S. Some people say Kailash. Some say Kailash. It's in the Himalayas. There's a Mount Kailash in the Himalayas. But I don't know if that's the same one.
That one where you go around and get a number of
times. Yeah, correct. But I don't know if it's exactly the same one where Shiva is. I tend to think it might be a different one. Mind you.
A lot of Hindus go there.
Yeah, oh yeah. Mind you, you know, you wouldn't see him anyway because he's on a different dimension. You'd have to be able to perceive that dimension. So he could be right there and you don't know he's there. Unless you could. Just like right now in this room. There are different beings that are here listening to this pastime, what we're talking about. But can you see them? Is the question. They're here. Okay, so why don't we meditate and see if we can enter into the depths of that kind of love. Close your eyes, breathe, relax, and let go. Deeply, deeply relax, and let go. Allow the stress, the tension, the fear, the apprehension to drain from your body. Totally, completely relax. Breathe and let go. High above, a beautiful beam of radiant pearl white light is coming down from the heavens. Down, down, all the way down. Entering through the top of your head, expanding throughout your head, torso, arms, legs, out the bottom of your feet, into the earth below. Breathe, relax, and let go. See and feel yourself by means of this light. Connected to the heavens above and grounded in the earth below. Relax. Okay. You're in an absolutely beautiful place in nature. You don't know this place. You've never been here before. It is lush, verdant green. All the trees have flowers or fruits or both. There are wonderful fragrances of all different kinds coming off the different plants around you. Even the breeze brings a beautiful fragrance of sandalwood. This is a heavenly type of place, not earthly. Now, sit in meditation, in your meditation, and open your heart. Focus on the heart and begin to open it gradually, like a lotus. Like a lotus in the morning sun. Open your heart and begin to manifest from within your heart a small little seed of love. Pure love. No conditions. No expectation, just pure, innocent, gentle love. And allow that seed now to sprout and grow and form a leaf, a bud, a flower, and expand your love. Now focus this love on God, on Spirit, and offer this love from your heart to your conception of God, the way you see God or Spirit. Offer the love. And pour your heart into it. Pour your being into this love. And let it go beyond all of your limitations, your fear, your hesitancy, your feelings of inadequacy, insufficiency. Let this love expand beyond all of these small human frailties and become so much bigger than you. Offer that to God. Now let God appear. Let Him appear to you. In whatever way, shape, or form He appears. And how does He appear? How do you see Him? And what is His attitude, His disposition when He sees you? How do you greet Him? How does He greet you? What's He say about your love? About your offering of the fruit of your heart? What's He say? Does He accept it? What does He do with it? Your heart's fruit. And what does He offer in exchange for your love? How does He reciprocate? Continue the meditation until you have finished the steps. And when you've finished, slowly return to consciousness, awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed, and at peace.